once you start kind of mixing in yoga and intent and creativity, you can use the medicine to get you to really interesting spaces to help you impact and connect with people in very positive ways or healing ways.
Welcome to the Alchemist Lounge. What if you could hang out with high-performing executives, entrepreneurs, and leaders? Ask them about how psychedelics have impacted their self-improvement journeys. Then take an insight or two to guide your own growth. Each week, Alex Atwood takes an in-depth look at how psychedelics can increase fulfillment, solve personal problems affecting your career, and help you gain the success you seek. Alex is an executive and psychedelics coach to high performers, and his goal is to provide strategies to help you reduce conflict, bring awareness, and balance your life through the use of psychedelics. Now, here's Alex.
Everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Alchemist Lounge. And today, the episode is with Sebastian Fouillade. Sebastian, did I say your last name correctly?
You nailed it. Fouillade. That's it. That's
awesome.
Right.
Good for me. So if you haven't heard of Sebastian, well, he's a podcast host, a journey coach, a facilitator, writer, musician, speaker. And his focus is always creating authentic journeys and helping others do the same. A little bit of background. He wasn't always in this space. He spent a lot of time working for Microsoft, which is probably one of the more matrixy companies that's out there. But he learned quite a bit from all of those years, 27 plus years in the corporate world. So I'd love to welcome Sebastian to the Alchemist Lounge.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Alex, for having me here. It's a pleasure.
It is a pleasure to meet you, my friend. So let's start somewhere. You describe something called authentic creativity. And I'm really curious about that. Tell me a little bit about authentic creativity.
Yeah, this is something that I feel like as I've got a five-year-old child, and she's amazing, and she just draws from her soul, and she'll draw with very few lines, and she's able to capture so much with her drawings. And you could see that it's empowering to her. She's able to tell stories with her drawings and all that. And one of the things, you know, as you get older, you get kind of programmed to create for work, for a job, for multiple reasons. And after a while, you kind of forget that authentic creation you had as a child. And so for me, the authentic creativity is that creativity that is transcending, that comes from you, from your soul, from your breath, from everything you put in there. And sometimes it's hard to get that in the corporate environment. But at the same time, this is probably what we need the most right now, because that's where innovation comes from. That's, you know, where you bring all your uniqueness to the table, and you're able to kind of just explore and without necessarily feeling judged. And I think there's the judgment is a big part as you get older, dealing with all that judgment, it impacts your creativity. And for me, it's been quite a journey because I used to draw a lot as a kid. And then I stopped for a while, started working with plant medicine 7 years ago. I reconnected with drawing, with playing music, with things that allowed me to explore a whole different side of myself and get more empowered in the process. And so this is one of the things I've been teaching others, and we did at our creativity retreat that we did back in October.
When you were saying that was like pure art, like art from the soul, art from the spirit, right? When we're young, we don't have much to refer to in terms of any sort of scaffolding coming on top of us. It's very, very pure. And what we draw, what we say, and what comes out of us at a younger age does come from the soul. So I'm curious about you. What was your youth like? Did you have a lot of creativity? Did you have a very artistic family that sort of brought this out of you?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. My mom was very artistic, though she wasn't doing that professionally. She wrote and she did paintings and drawings. Her sister is a famous French painter. Her brother was in the French movie industry. But when I grew up, I was always taught, don't be an artist, because it's a very difficult life. And here are some examples in the family. And so I was always scared of that, but I could never really, you know, separate myself from it. It was part of me. So I tried to trick the system by getting into computer engineering which I was like, well, computers can allow me to create. And they did. And that's kind of how I started in there. But I would sketch on my notebooks while the teachers were like giving, you know, classes. I would get in trouble for that. I couldn't stop creating. And it's something that, you know, I see our kids today with like cell phones, and it, I just feels like it's taking away those moments of boredom where you end up having to create on your own, because it always gives them something to do. And now we've got things like Midjourney and Stable Diffusion. For people who aren't familiar with it, it's the AI-supported art creation where you don't even have to create anymore. You just give a prompt and you get back a piece of art. And so an important journey on creativity for humanity right now, you know, where is that going? And recognizing the value of creating for yourself, you know, like the act of creating. And that's something I'm really pushing out there of, you know, like it's healthy to create and you should want to be a creator and do the hard work.
Yeah. Tell me about what self-expression looked like in terms of creativity for you in your formative years, right? Around maybe your teenage years when you were kind of being stifled, it sounds like a bit, right? Your parents didn't really want you to be the artist that you had inside, it doesn't sound like.
Well, I love comic books. So in my teenage years, I was in New York City. And so, you know, this was kind of like the mecca for comic books. So I would get the Spider-Man comic books. I think it was The Amazing Spider-Man by Mac Furlane, then the middle of the early 90s. I mean, I would draw like a lot of technology. I mean, I love technology. I would draw robots. I watched Star Trek a lot. So I was like, oh, yeah, one day we're going to be able to create robots. So I would like plan all this out, you know, and I played a lot of video games, like Nintendo games, like platformers. So I would draw like whole levels on there. And that's, you know, for me, drawing was a way to just manifest inventions and creations. And it's changed a lot since then. Now it's more free-flowing and it's manifesting ideas and concepts and feelings. But back then, it was just adventures and exploration. Mm. You'd hope for like kids nowadays, you want them to be able to explore that side of themselves.
Yeah, I'm going to nerd out a little bit with you right now because you just mentioned comic books. So that era, early 90s, I was more 80s, late 80s, of Amazing Spider-Man, yeah. Peter Parker, Spectacular Spider. There was like three or four different books happening at that time. And I remember the plots were pretty fascinating. There was the Spidey suit that was turning into its own character and starting to become evil, right? And the transition between what comic books were in the early 80s, mid 80s, and then what they sort of turned into by the 90s was a massive difference. I mean, it was very dramatic. The fantasy there was unbelievable. And I remember as a kid, I also used to draw comic books. As a matter of fact, I came up with my own character at the time based on some of the Spider-Man villains and wanted to create sort of the anti-hero. But what was really fascinating for me and what really compelled me towards these books was the storylines. I mean, they were always evolving. They were so imaginative. And to me, I thought, you know, at the time, the 80s and 90s, early 90s, you know, sci-fi and computer animation had not really caught up to our imaginations yet, right?
Yeah.
And slowly as they started to catch up, I can really understand how that excitement, especially if the career that you pursued in terms of technology, you were right there on the advancement of everything, right? So did you see that evolution and were you a part of that through your career?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because it was in 1989, I was using some very basic 3D rendering programs to do a space station and rotate a space station and animate that. And the computer wouldn't take pictures. So I had a camera and I would take the pictures separately. And I somehow composed a film like separately from the computer. What the computer did is render each frame. It was very awkward, but I could see that. And when I was reading the book, it's funny, I remember reading the X-Men comic book, and I could just picture the Wolverine, and I knew Wolverine and his claws coming out was going to be like so great on screen. The special effects would catch up with that. And I was like, oh, that's the first movie they got to make. And I always love that aspect of computers to kind of bring all this to life. In fact, like if you look at Steve Jobs when he started, for him, computers were about creativity. It was about bringing a lot of ideas and creativity to life. And it's changed a lot since then. It's a whole industry. I mean, like we're using them for our talk right now, so much beyond. But like back then, and I love it. It's like kids, even kids nowadays, they can always see much further the older people because they're growing up in a completely different environment.
Well, your career did follow technology, right? Tell me a little bit about that. I want to hear about Sebastian before the big mind shift, before the breakthrough. What did that look like? Because that was a long part of your life.
Yeah. No, it's funny because in the 90s, I was on a summer job and I was working for a company that installed networks for big companies in New York City. And one of the customers wanted a website. And so I was like, oh, well, I can do that for you. And at the time, it was like 93, 94. And so websites were basically people who've done like print work, who put like print stuff on the web. And, you know, there's nothing about UX and UI and responsive design and databases and all that. So I can do that. I was studying computer engineering. So I started doing that. And I basically turned this into a company while I was at Boston University and in college. So last 2 years of Boston University, I was hiring my friends to build websites. We were building websites with database backends, dynamic websites. And I didn't want to get a corporate job then. I was like, you know, I'm going to take the tough path, the path less traveled. All my friends were getting like cushy jobs at the time. And I did that. And I opened an office in Oregon. I left Boston, opened an office in Oregon. And 3 years later, I sold the company because I burned myself out trying to run a startup when I was really young. It was a lot of fun. And in hindsight, after I sold it, I was like, huh, we weren't doing so bad. But sometimes you kind of got to let something go in order to like really be able to reflect on it. And so that's kind of what happened then. And then it was 9/11 and the dot-com bubble burst. And things started getting really challenging. Like the Oregon job market was like the worst in the nation then. So after that, I basically got into the corporate track. So I worked for a startup for a little bit. They went under after 9/11 and led most of the staff off, which was really hard because it was a beautiful startup. Then worked for different companies like corporate. I did another startup 11 years ago to get families out in nature, to help families reconnect with nature. So there was always that desire to kind of go after the windmills or go after the path less traveled. And when I moved to the Northwest in 2008, I noticed that all the parents would give their kids their phones as babysitting tools. And I was like, that's just messed up. Like, how do kids go outside anymore and connect with nature? Because it's such an important part of who we are. And so I was at Microsoft at the time doing robotics, and we were studying the American families to see how we could put another screen in front of them, like a robot in front of them. And I was like, wow, that's kind of messed up. So let me start a company that goes against that and uses the devices to get the families outdoors, organize scavenger hunts, sponsor that by eco-friendly companies. And so I did this for 2 years and then realized, well, that's not the way companies want to spend their money, their marketing money. And so our business model didn't really hold. But we had like 5,000 parents that loved us in the Seattle area. And it's just wonderful experience. But in parallel of that, it's when my spiritual journey started.
That's a perfect bridge. It sounds like you've been very intentional about what you've done thus far. In other words, it doesn't sound like you're the type that kind of let the corporate rigidity like tie you in. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it's all very intentional. It's knowing why I'm doing certain things. Am I doing them for the family, for myself? And if I'm not happy somewhere, I don't like people who are unhappy and they're staying in their job. And like, there's a lot of people like that, and they grumble and they complain and they stay in it. And I always feel like if I'm going to go do a corporate job, I'm going to give it everything. And if I'm unhappy, I'm going to go do something else. If I'm burned out, I'm going to do something else. I'm going to take a breather and maybe I'll come back. But, you know, I have to respect that and be intentional about it. And so, and that's what I recommended to like people on my team too, is like, hey, if you're not happy, if it's not for you, like I'll support you. Go find something else. But yeah, it's always been very intentional.
When did your spiritual journey begin?
Well, when I was doing that startup to get families outdoors, I decided to reconnect with yoga because I was like, if I'm going to do a startup and work at Microsoft at the same time, that's a little intense. So I need something that helps me center myself and ground myself. And so I went to this great yoga studio in Kirkland called the Ashram Yoga. It's burned down since then, but wonderful, wonderful yoga studio. And it was hot power yoga. And then one day the teacher tells us, is like, hey, there's this class called Kriya Yoga. It's a workshop that we offer on the weekend. And would you be interested? And I was like, I've got an open mind.
It's intense.
Kriya Yoga, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
I had no idea what I was walking into. And so I get there. I think it was like a Saturday at 5 p.m. or something like that. And the teacher is like, okay, you're going to sit here for 2 hours, your eyes closed, and you're going to listen to my cues. And it was basically like excruciating, like breath work for like 2 hours that reduced me to nothing. And at the end of those 2 hours, I had an out-of-body experience. Basically, you know, like I was in two places at once. And I was like, oh my God, that spiritual stuff is true. I'd like a little tear, and, you know, because my background is like, again, like engineering. And even though I was creative, I was like brought up Roman Catholic and, you know, war on drug and all that. Like, I didn't believe in all that woo-woo stuff. And so when that happened, I was somewhere else. I saw like a design on the wall. And I was like, wow, I need to explore more. And that kind of started the journey where I was also learning transcendental meditation at the time. So I did more meditation. Cannabis became legal. I actually tried cannabis and meditation together to see how much deeper I could go. I did float tanks. And it changed my entire life, my personal life, my work life.
Yeah. And, we're going to dig in a little bit. But first of all, the breath work being the introduction to deep spiritual space, like, you know, psychedelic journeys through breath work, is something that I've had guests on the show talk through it. I've shared in the past that on my first ayahuasca retreat, one of the modalities that we used was breathwork. As a matter of fact, Pablo, who was my breathwork instructor during that retreat, I had him on the show and told him that was the most powerful part of my journey and of my entire retreat. And for those of you that are listening, a lot of times you'll hear about ayahuasca and powerful, potent psychedelics, but your own body, your own breath can take you to places that ayahuasca hasn't even taken me to. So that's a footnote.
I spent a week with Wim Hof in Peru and his family. And, you know, he didn't participate in any of the ceremonies because he can generate his own DMT through his own breath work, which is crazy, but I totally believe it. And you can see it and just how he is, how present he is, and how he interacts with the world. And so that was another little side note and nod at Wim, who's an amazing person.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't know, Wim Hof is known as the Iceman, and he's written multiple books on breath work, multiple books on the therapeutic, and honestly, the impact that the cold can have on body, your spirit, your mind, your energy. So definitely, you know, check out Wim Hof. So when you were in that breathwork experience and suddenly you found yourself in sort of like a duality, all of a sudden you're in two places, right? What made you trust that experience? Like, in other words, why not think, oh, this is an experience that's like, you know, I'm having, my mind is playing tricks on me. Like, what was it that had you think this was a transformational experience?
I think there's a little bit of starting to have faith and surrendering kind of that analytical mind that I had kind of relied so much upon for like many years. And it started when I was doing meditation, which started at around the same time, which is like, don't try to analyze everything. You know, sometimes just take it for what it is. And I like to compare it to like, if you're going on a hike and there's beautiful flowers everywhere, you're not going to like start analyzing every single flower. You just kind of take it in. And so it's around the same time where I started just having faith and just more willingness to surrender to it and accept it and just accept those things. Sure, I could explain them scientifically, and I still speak to family members who will try to explain everything about the chemistry in my brain and what happens. And I'm like, you know, it's like, try to experience it and then tell me if your scientific explanation does justice to what you just experienced.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's pretty much it.
It's true. You know, they call it the beginner's mind, taking that approach where really just kind of suspending your initial attachment to whatever you think it might be and allowing for that to open up. So there you were, you had a breakthrough through Kriya Yoga, which is a very intense form of yoga, which you didn't expect.
I didn't expect it. I was like, oh my God. And then I did it 10 more times as part of yoga teacher training, which I took after that.
So how did you discover psychedelics from that point?
It wasn't for a while. It's funny because, you know, like I talk about psychedelics a lot and everybody assumes I started with psychedelics, but it came on later when my wife and I were dating and she was going down to the Amazon jungle to the Temple of the Way of Light to do an ayahuasca retreat. I couldn't join her because there was a wait list. So I ended up going to retreats, local retreats run by the Native American church who were allowed to conduct ayahuasca and San Pedro ceremonies. And so I joined, I don't know if it was 3 or 4 nights in a row of ayahuasca ceremonies with the Native American church. And it was the most amazing experience. I mean, I saw in the first ceremony, I saw the birth of our daughter like 2 years before she was born. It was outside around a big bonfire. And because of all the work that I had done, and this is something I like to tell to people, is like, don't look at just psychedelics on their own, but like there's yoga, meditation, all that works together. And so because of all the work I had done before, the breath work, the yoga, the meditation, all that made it so that I seamlessly went into those ceremonies to that higher level and experienced so much love, so much connection, gained so many insights on my family and my relationships. Connected with my wife. This is a funny story. I connected with my wife who was doing ceremonies in the jungle at the same time. And because I still had that engineering spirit, I was like, honey, I'm going to give you a number. And when I meet you, when you come back, tell me the number and we'll see if we really connected. And so, and she couldn't talk to me while she was down there. It was like no communication. And so she returns from the jungle, like, I don't know, a week or two later. And I was like, okay, so what was the number? She's like, I don't know. I mean, I felt your presence, honey, but like, I can't remember any numbers. Like she gave me like, man, maybe it's 21. And I was like, oh shoot, that didn't work. And it not until like a year later that I realized what the number was and the message behind it. I was browsing an old French photo album. In the margin, I see 6-3, Anniversaire de Maman. And it was like, it was my mother's birthday. And I was forgetting the exact day. It was every year. And so the first message I got from ayahuasca, like the first night when I actually tried to trick the system and prove what was happening, was like, this is your mother's birthday and you will never forget it. And there's a lot of motherly love in ayahuasca. Yeah. So, you know, this a beautiful thing that happened.
You know, it's funny, you know, when you're in the medicine, and for those of you who aren't listening, this may sound a little out there, but when you're in the medicine, you go to a certain realm, let's call it, where possibilities are endless and the possibility of being not just able to reach out to somebody who's currently alive in the world, but to those who are no longer with us in the world, like actually connecting and connecting to a higher power is something that's actually attainable. And but what I've discovered is that much like what you found in your breath work, that connecting in that same way is also available outside of the psychedelic space. I think the psychedelic space just, it's almost like a kick in the head. It's just like, there's a lot of breaths you have to take. There's a lot of meditation to do and silencing to do to be able to hear and listen into that realm. And the psychedelics open it up a bit so that all of us are able to kind of take a step into that realm. Does that sound like your experience as well?
Oh yeah, totally. And I would add that the way people can work with psychedelics, there's so many ways. And, you know, right now the big conversation is around mental health. But once you start kind of mixing in yoga and intent and creativity, you can use the medicine to get you to really interesting spaces to help you impact and connect with people in very positive ways or healing ways. There's so much that can be done once you're in that space. And at the same time, at least for me, it takes a lot to be in that space. So it's not a space that I necessarily want to continually be around, but you know, that I like to cherish every ceremony like it's a gift and it could be my last one. And I want to honor it as such and take the learnings from it and use them in my life afterward.
That's a great bridge, because I'm curious about what inspired you to write a book about your experience, right? You wrote a book, I think it was Stairway to Healing.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So it was a few years later. So I'd already been through quite a bit of ayahuasca ceremonies, but the book is about a challenging time I had where I had kind of an emotional kind of breakdown. I didn't know where it was coming from, but I was sick. I had some fever and just gone through a divorce, and I had 3 kids, my corporate job, and I just felt like I was overworked and everything. Like a lot of people have probably felt last few years with everything that's been going on. And I was overwhelmed, even though I had all those tools, I was overwhelmed. And so I went down to Peru to try to find some healing, working with the medicine again. And the book is about that. But I wrote the book for my children at first. I wrote it for my kids because I would go on those journeys, I would do that work, but like they have no idea what I was doing there. And I would talk about it with them, but I wanted to document that so they would know it's like, hey, how your dad is approaching the journey, and you know, I'm responsible in the way I approach it. What happened there is not like mysterious, can talk about it. And when you're ready, don't want them to be too young. So like I'm waiting for them to be old enough to read it. But I told them, I was like, once you're old enough, feel free to read it. I think if they're too young, it's going to be boring for them. And friends of mine wanted to hear about it too. So I started writing about it. And it was basically a slice in time. It was from my journal. And because I love journaling, so I would basically journal all the time through that retreat. And then I took that journal and turned it into a book, my first book, which I learned a lot in the process. It's a very mental exercise to write a book, and I have a lot of respect for writers, even more respect as a result. Mm.
Speaking about writing, you've done quite a bit of writing since that first book. And going back to creativity, you have a retreat in Peru now that is around sacred creativity. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, it's funny because it's a little different from other retreat centers. It's basically, we run the retreat when I feel like it.
I like that.
I used to work, so I tried to help an outfit before the pandemic. They were trying to run retreats every month, and it was exhausting, and it was exhausting for the staff, and it spread their market too thin, and there was a lot of problems with that. And so after the pandemic, as about a year ago, my friend Kunti that I worked with in the past, she's a Mexican medicine woman, reached out to me and she's like, hey, like, do you want to work together again? Do you want to do a retreat? And I was like, yeah, you know, like, I think so. I mean, I've always wanted to work with her. We talked a lot in the past and She's a very talented artist and medicine woman. But in the past, we talk that when she does retreats, she just does medicine work and she never brings in her other facets of her artistic side. I mean, she sings during the ceremonies, but we wanted to do more. And so we had this concept of like, how can we create a retreat that would allow us to be our whole selves to the guests? So it's really, initially, it was really about us being able to organize a retreat where we could be free to be us.
Yeah.
And so that would involve teaching art workshops, music workshops. And that's kind of how the retreat was born of like, let's help others reconnect with that creativity, reconnect with their whole self. And we're all creators in one way or another. So, and it's very empowering, you know, like a lot of people who've had trauma, being able to create is a simple way where they can start, you know, regaining some of that confidence, some of that power, some of that voice that is important to move them forward. So this is how the Secret Creativity was born. And then with all my experience in product management from Microsoft and tech companies, I was like, oh, I want to craft the perfect customer journey. So every single details from like preparation to the retreat itself to the integration was like crafted. We created like a journey kit that I blessed with tapestries from the healer that I went to get before the retreat down in Peru that we put in the kit. We sent little videos to each person as I blessed the kit. The whole experience, even during the retreat, was amazing. And we had things like a mountain fire that threatened the retreat. And one night we went to bed the night before the first ayahuasca retreat, and we didn't know if we were going to get a knock on the door at 3 a.m. because the mountain fire was like right next to the center. And magically in the morning, it was gone. Mm. And this is Peru. Like, you don't have like firefighters like we have in the US. This was like villagers with a shovel and a face mask going on the mountain to throw dirt on the flames.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. It's something. Yeah. Oh, we also added brain mapping. So I have a friend who does brain mapping for retreat centers. In fact, I'm about to put his interview out this week or next week. But he does medical grade like EEGs, reading of brainwave. And so they can identify normalization of brainwaves and changes in brain plasticity. Hmm. And so we did brain mapping before the ayahuasca ceremonies and brain mapping after the ayahuasca ceremonies. And everybody had like a 30 to 50% improvement in brain normalization and brain plasticity, which is, it's amazing. And so, yeah, the retreat was
unbelievable.
Awesome. Wow. I can dive in anywhere.
Wow. There's a lot. First of all, there's a lot to unpack there. So, yeah. so you were actually able to, first of all, promote this incredible self-expression by everybody that was coming in. So the name Sacred Creativity is a special name because you're holding sacred one's own creativity, right? And what I think of, the first thing that comes in is full authenticity and full self-expression, right? So did you find that when you have the brain mapping and you have all this programming that allows for a container that brings in self-expression and brings in that sort of data point, right, around what's been achieved? Like, how did that look for the participants leaving there? That's a lot different than any other retreat that I've heard of.
Yeah, we just scratched the surface on what we could be doing. So the first question was like, were the participants able to really reach that state of sacred creativity? And the way we organized the schedule and the whole journey was to slowly kind of soften the foundation or maybe been hardened over the year. It's like we slowly got them there. And first, it was the journey kit that we send them. We had a lot of pre-meetings beforehand to talk about creativity, to get to know each other, because you also want to break down some of the defenses that people are so used in having when you have something like that. And a lot of time with group ceremonies, people get a lot of anxiety, not knowing who's going to be there, assertion against other people. So we really wanted to make sure we had the right chemistry and the right container and environment that would allow people to be themselves. And so that started like before the ceremonies, that started actually before the retreat, where we spent 2 days together in the city of Pisac. And I would actually just feel people's energies. We would have lunch together. We would get to know each other. And so spending that time for the group to get to know each other is an important part of the process. And then once we got together, I mean, we started with like Cambo, which, you know, is very intense, a very intense cleansing process. And that was a group experience. So going through that intense process together creates connections, which also, again, enables people to be more free to be themselves. And then you kind of build it up a little more. Then after that, I had the music workshop, which was my way to do a little bit of Mr. Miyagi and hide breath work and teaching people how to play harmonica and mouth harp before the first ayahuasca ceremony. But even the way I approached this was starting with the foundation, starting with the humming and being curious about your sounds, your voice, and slowly working this out to people being able to express themselves again. It's almost like dealing with a wild animal, like a deer. It's like you don't want to scare them. You want to be very gentle. And so each person needed to get reacquainted with that creativity and be gentle with it and see it and watch it and let it grow. So by the time we got to the art workshop, I had people who had never painted, who had broken their hand and couldn't hold a brush, painting with their hands and painting things that were amazing, that, you know, I would never have expected them to paint, and they would never have expected it themselves. And it was a small ceremony. We kept it intentionally small. We had about 5 guests, so we could also give everybody the attention they needed in the process, which is really important. It's all like with a lot of care and love for each person, but everybody was able to express themselves. I mean, one guy was like ex-Marine, and I would never have expected him to sing, but on the last ayahuasca night, it was a full moon, and we were doing a moon song, which was a native, and he joined us because we had practiced that song during the music workshop, and he joined us. And we had such a big laugh when he joined us, and we were all so happy, and he was so happy. And so, you know, being able to see that transformation for each other's person was wonderful. And then following them afterward to see how they're doing back in life is also an amazing experience.
Absolutely. Very fulfilling, very nourishing. And a small group I've found really allows for that sort of connection. A lot more larger retreat groups that are now sort of forming. I'm sure there's some places that can do it very well, but I can really appreciate the smaller group where there's care taken, there's connection there. It really just builds something that is very unique. Yeah.
Yeah.
And holding that self-expression is incredible.
Yeah, the economics of a retreat work better with larger groups.
Yeah.
Because you can charge $2,000-$3,000 per person. You can return a nice profit with a larger group. I would tell people if they're looking at larger group, try to find places where the ratio of a facilitator to guest is like a 1-to-3 ratio or 1-to-2 ratio. But like, you know, if you have a 1 facilitator for 4 guests, it starts being challenging to hold that space for the facilitators. And the retreat project was probably one of the more complex projects that I've worked on. And that's looking at all the tech projects I've worked on in my life, because it's a human project and there's so many variables into it. And going to a medicine retreat is a risk. There's a risk everybody takes. And there's a risk as a facilitator and organizer trying to mitigate those risks, but there's always risks. You're dealing with people's soul, people's livelihood. And we took this very seriously, but at the same time, people have to be careful when they sign up for these to make sure the organizer treats it as such.
Very good point. Very good point to those looking to attend a psychedelic or a medicine retreat. Sort of wrapping this up, I want to draw a thread between leadership and self-expression. You have a podcast called Leadershipadelics, which I love. Draw that thread for me, right? So everything you've talked about so far really points at creativity, self-expression, really learning your own voice. I love the story you just told about the Marine who kind of found his own voice during a ceremony, which is very literal, but it happens in a very non-literal way as well. Tell me how that translates into Leadershipadelics and how you're able to sort of create the new leaders, right?
Yeah, I started Leadershipadelics because I was dissatisfied with what I was seeing in leadership and some of the places I worked at. I wanted to see more human leadership, like authentic leadership. I also wanted to see more creativity where we're not afraid to reach higher, to accomplish bolder, more beautiful things. That's how the podcast came about. And also there's a quote from Steve Jobs that said, I think if Bill Gates had dropped more LSD, Microsoft would have been a different company.
That's very true.
I think so as well. So that kind of inspired me to start the podcast. And leadership odelics means manifestation. So psychedelics is manifestations of the psyche. Leadership odelics is manifestations of leadership. And so what I found through the podcast, great leaders are also able to do their own work on themselves and dealing with traumas, going through their journey. Because if they don't deal with their own wounds, it's going to impact the people around them. It's going to impact how they lead. And so the podcast is very much about talking to people who've done that work and who've changed the way they run their lives. And I use leadership in a very broad sense. It's not just about, oh, well, I'm a CEO here, and so I'm a leader. No, it's like everyone is a leader in my mind because you're leading your own life. If you have a family, you're a leader in the family. If you're a community, you're a leader. If you're at work, you're a leader. And so how do you manifest that better future? And that manifestation demands creativity too, because how you're going to create that vision that you can crystallize. And so it kind of all comes together of like creativity is a huge part of leadership and authentic creativity. We need that authentic creativity right now. We don't need more copycats and followers. There's a lot of that already. So that's why I started the podcast.
Yeah, I love that. Leadership is leaders aren't given titles and suddenly become leaders. Leaders are able to speak authentically, communicate vulnerably, and do so with self-expression. And, you know, any leader I've had, whether an instructor, a teacher, a coach, the way that I've been touched by someone has always been through vulnerability. It's been through, you know, sharing something, right? I've been manipulated through other ways, and you don't necessarily know it's a manipulation until later. But I think that the new generation of leaders and people like you who are crafting what it looks like to lead in this age of Aquarius, in this new age that we're all going through, is something very special. And thank you for being a torchbearer there. So those that are listening,
thank you.
They are probably waiting in bated breath when you decide to have your next retreat. Is there one on the calendar right now? Is there anywhere someone can sign up for the creativity, sacred creativity retreat?
Well, they can go to my personal site and follow the link. My personal site is fouyad.com, fouyad.com, and follow the link to the Sacred Creativity Retreat. And there's a mailing list where we'll announce it. Right now, it looks like it would be spring of next year. And the reason it takes so long is we put a lot of effort to craft it, a lot of attention. We want to make sure we have the right people. And I'm still trying to figure out the proper pricing structure because we use a really nice retreat center in Peru, great accommodation. Peru is not in a very stable state right now. They just, I think, put the president in jail and are trying to put another president in place. For 12 days, all my attention was, and then before that, they had COVID. We really lucked out in that space we had to run the retreat. And so I want to make sure it's a safe environment for the guests. I want to make sure we can pay everyone on our staff properly. And I also want to make sure it just makes sense for me and kind of where I'm at in the journey. And it took me a month to recover from running the retreat because given to the people who attended the retreat. And for 6 months before that was promoting the retreat and organizing it. And then after that, it's still following up with them. So it's a lot of work behind the scene that people don't see. And I don't want to scale it either. That's the other thing. People are like, oh, you know, you can scale it. You can hire people to do this and do that. It's like, no, I actually like to do the work. I like to be part of the ceremonies and be connected with the medicine. This is part of my journey, is to do that work. And so I don't need to delegate that part, but I also don't need to do it every month. I don't have anything to prove.
Wow. So coming at some point next year, there will be another, hopefully another Sacred Creativity Retreat. Thank you so much for coming on the show. For those that are more interested in learning about Sebastian, you can go to www.fooyad.com. That's F-O-O-Y-A-D. He did us all a favor. He used the phonetic pronunciation of his last name. And for those interested in listening to his podcast, it's called Leadershipadelics. I think it's fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing your journey and for sharing all of your gifts with the world at large. You're clearly somebody that's been on a very unique and yet very connected and singular journey. And thank you for sharing it with us. I'm excited to possibly attend the ceremony in 2024. I was really lit up by the way that you guys facilitate that. So I'll be definitely looking at your website to see more updates there. And again, thanks so much for coming on the show, Sebastian.
Thank you, Alex.
Thanks for listening in to the Alchemist Lounge. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review on Apple iTunes. To catch all the latest from Alex Atwood, you can check out his website at alexatwood.co. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next time at the Alchemist Lounge.